Next on The Old Mole, in part one of a three-part interview, Luisa Martinez speaks with Mitch Green, PhD. He is a heterodox economist, and he's going to explain the differences between mainstream economies and the heterodox school of economic thought.
This is Luisa Martinez, and I'm very excited to be able to speak with my friend, comrade, and for the purposes of this interview, economist Mitch. Mitch is a PhD economist living in Portland. He teaches classes at Portland Community College. He also researches and works on issues related to energy economics as a research scholar for the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity. He, just like I am, a first-generation college student, anti-imperialist army veteran, lover of dogs, and winner of several jazzercise competitions. I had no idea. Hey, Mitch, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, and thanks for repping my jazzercise cred.
Yeah, I had to throw that in there. Just make sure that everybody knows that about you. So to give folks an understanding of the distinctions that we'll be discussing today, I wanted to read a summary of the two visions of society that these two schools of thought give us. So in the mainstream view of economics, the economy is fundamentally scarce, right? And that people are fundamentally self-interested and they want the moon, and that markets are necessary to allocate those scarce resources and ensure that they're put to the best use. Alternatively, in heterodox economics, the economy is a social provisioning process where key features of its organization are socially constructed. So we make those decisions collectively, and that resources are produced and not inherently scarce. And this is a much more open and discretionary view of how we can kind of shape the world. So Mitch, can you expound on these two perspectives and what implications they have on how society is structured versus maybe what is possible?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. When I teach this stuff, I start with the tension of these two definitions because it really draws out how, depending upon your worldview, the way society is structured, you can end up with quite different analyses and profoundly different implications for policy, because at the end of the day, it's about policy. So the first perspective takes as granted this idea that markets are this sort of quote-unquote natural inevitability as the sort of primary institution by which we govern our economic life process. So all human beings have an economic life process, right? Even if there's no quote-unquote economy, as we think of it in the modern sense. We have to live. We have to get our bread, right? So whereas the second perspective starts by recognizing that markets are just institutions, and institutions are just the product of human ingenuity, and in some sense are just arbitrary and are an artifact of the way that we have constructed ourselves socially. So they're not inevitable in the sense of them being kind of natural, right? But rather they are socially constructed and subject to reflection on how they came into being and for what purpose they serve. So I'd like to think of like summing up the heterodox approach is generally to think in terms about economics as this bigger thing, like this big kind of science of social provisioning where big questions are posed, where mainstream analysis is actually quite limited and narrow in scope and very specific to only kind of market exchange problems, which is a tiny sliver of the human experience.
Okay, so maybe to bring it to the ground, when our listeners get fully vaccinated, right, and the CDC says it's okay to do so, head home, hug their families, and then when they get to the dinner table, they'll hear things like perhaps that we can't pay for universal healthcare and we can't pay for things like free college. So, you know, if there was a heterodox economist at the dinner table, what would they say?
Well, a lot of heterodox economists are well-read and have oftentimes really kind of folksy quips for those sorts of things. So one of my favorite is a quote by Mark Twain where he says, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so." And that kind of lets us encounter this idea that there are certain enabling myths, certain truths that we take for granted with a capital T that are actually not an accurate reflection of the world we live in. So if you kind of let that you know, Mark Twain quote sit with you for a second, and then also consider another proposition, which is to put it simply that if a thing is technologically possible to do, like if we have the skills and the plans and the machines to do a thing and accomplish something, then there's always a way to pay for it. Money is very real. It's a social relationship, and social relationships are grounded in a material experience. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of people through COVID have realized that money is not so scarce as maybe we were taught to believe. And so if there's a will and a vision and the technology to envision a problem and solve it, then of course you can pay for it. That's how I would start with that.
So what do you mean when you say that COVID has demonstrated that money is not as scarce as people to believe? Because there's a lot of people who are obviously struggling, right? Who did lose their jobs.
That's true. I think that for those who have followed fiscal policy or what Congress is doing in terms of legislating spending packages, the scale at which we have spent and appropriated new dollars into the economy is staggering by comparison to what we came out of during the Obama years, which was all very austerity driven, all very kind of let's all tighten our belts, including the government. And we have continued to pass multi-trillion dollar packages, and it has not had a consequence of any kind, you know, an expansion of the money supply, for instance, causing runaway inflation. Like none of that has materialized. It's not going to. And the kind of Overton window has shifted in such a way where people are no longer taking for granted this idea that we can't afford things. That's what I mean by that. People are struggling, but in the aggregate, there's simply more money flowing through the economy, and it's gotten into people's pockets at the end of the day than you would have expected going into this.
So that's interesting, the comments that you make about the money flowing into the economy and the government choosing to do so, because anybody who's ever taken microeconomics, macroeconomics in high school or college, one of the first things that you learn about is inflation, right? And this idea that if you just print more money, it'll cause massive inflation. And then a gallon of milk will cost $250. What would a heterodox economist say to that?
Not all heterodox economists are created equal in this regard. There are still some heterodox economists who believe in that fantasy, and we'll call them sound money socialists, for lack of a better term. But I would say the lion's share would simply say that's based upon a fable and a fantasy and a abstract view about the relationship between the central bank on the one hand and the relationship between kind of like reserves and money creation on the other. It's based upon this gold standard thinking or the view that money is like a commodity, whereas most heterodox economists would recognize that money is this much more sort of non-finite resource that expands based upon the, you know, what's going on in the economy as a whole. And it's not limited by any kind of quantum of commodities that exist in society, if that makes sense. That might be too heady at this.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you bring up COVID. How might you have handled the beginning of COVID as an economist?
Man, if you had put me in the driver's seat and said, you have all the tools to craft policy, go, I would have immediately nationalized all the payrolls immediately. And I would have said, basically, all payrolls, however big or small, are just going to be continue to be paid directly by the Treasury. And I would have kind of nationalized production chains that were of essential importance, such as around like PPE, stuff like that, and mandated a stay at home and do a full lockdown. Because the only reason that individuals or firms or state governments opposed that, even in the beginning, is because they were worried about how they're going to pay for their payrolls or how are they going to get money to service their needs. And so changing nothing else, if you would have simply said, look, if there's a payroll to be met somewhere, we will pick up the tab as the federal government, then everyone could have been made whole, including all the folks who would like to reduce their influence. You know, like I'm all for taking money away from the rich, but if that's a second order consideration, as opposed to the kind of primary thing of responding to a crisis, you could have even made them whole too and not had to make a sacrifice anywhere. So I'm saying I would have simply kept paying the bills as the Treasury, whatever the dollar cost, and instituted a proper lockdown. And we would have never took the casualties that we did.
That's amazing, because the idea of literally locking down the country sounds less crazy than paying everybody, than nationalizing the payrolls, as you kind of propose. Yeah.
Well, it's some of these things, it's really hard to shake off conventional thinking. I have students who are like super progressive and really want to change the world, but get locked into this kind of mainstream sort of thinking that you might find on a Reddit forum about how the economy works, for instance, that's based upon like really toy models and really simple ways of thinking that thinks this is the best of all possible worlds. And you have to make these really hard trade-offs. But when you step back and realize the economy is this much more open and socially contested space, and that what you're really fighting for is institutions, then it's a much different ballgame.
That's fascinating. I'm actually going to be talking to Mitch a couple more times, so I look forward to sharing that with everybody. Mitch, thanks so much for this first round.
Thanks for having me. Excited to come back.
See what they would do. They said, son,